After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
You know, one thing at a time. Can we cut down on our air travel? Can we do that? Are there new generations of engineers that are coming up with, you know, new sources of clean energy? That's actually happening pretty quickly, you know, right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are very large forces, and at the same time, there are individuals that are, you know, making decisions and living their lives. And if each one of us did that, each 8 billion of us, we can begin to, you know, tip things.
Hi, everyone. It's Raghu back with Mind Rolling. And I'm back with Susan Bauer Wu. Great to have you. Welcome to the podcast, Susan.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So I do want to hear about how all of this evolved for you in terms of the work that you've done for Mind Life Institute, which Susan has worked with for many years. But I kind of want to start off because this image, I mean, I am one of an archetypical person who is, of course, completely interested and understands to whatever extent I can the interconnectivity of everything, mm-hmm. from the earliest days with psychedelics to, you know, the decades I've spent doing practice. And I still am not finding a way to relate with it properly, especially after reading some of the different material in the book. But yesterday, there was a problem for me, because I love animals so much, one of the most horrific images was the whales, I think in Australia, that came together in a heart. I'm sure you saw that. And beached, and half of them are dead, and they're trying to keep the other half alive. Here's my reaction. I could not even go to the article. I did not even want, I couldn't see this extraordinary event where they came together in that shape. I mean, really, really quite something. And so, yeah, just starting with the reality of who we are. And even people like myself who want to contribute, who do want to do something, who want to make changes in their own lives regarding this, who still are shying away from facing it by not, you know, not absorbing what really happened in that moment. Just your own perspective of, I'm sure you've met, you know, I'm one of a gazillion people.
Yeah, I'm two. Oh. You know, I share. I mean, I've every single day that I wake up, we're faced with, you know, another headline that's just breaking our hearts. And it can feel like it's too much to bear. I don't know if you know, there's a new word out there. Maybe it's not a new word, but it became new for me, called solastalgia.
Say that again.
Solastalgia.
No, solastalgia. What is
yeah,
that?
Yeah, let me.
Sounds horrible. I'm probably going to be.
It's Solastalgia.
Hmm.
And it's a new word for like climate heartbreak.
Oh, really?
And climate grief. Yeah, it's a new word.
Wow.
Because that's what we're experiencing as a collective, many of us. And I think that we can't deny the heartbreak that we're experiencing, that we're witnessing, that we know is happening. Even if we're not experiencing it directly, we know it's happening, as you described it, you know, across the world. And so if we lean into it and we're with it, as one of my, you know, wisdom teachers, Lama Will of Life Baker, describes as, you know, metabolizing it. You know, there's this process of metabolizing and being with and creating space around what is true. Mm. The truth of suffering, you know, that's the,
yeah,
you know, that's the Dharma, we know it. And at the same time, the other truth is that with the sorrow, there's also beauty, there's connection, there's love. And we ride the waves of both.
Mm.
That's how I'm doing it. You know, one breath at a time, one moment at a time.
It's a little bit like our Buddhist friends and teachers do suggest to us, not to run from dark thoughts, emotions. Mm-hmm. Rather, invite them in. And Ram Dass used to say, when he first came back from India, here's the way to deal with these kind of demons is invite them in for a cup of tea. Mm-hmm. And, you know, connect and allow rather than push away or run away. And I suppose in that same breath, it's about what this word again, solastalgia.
Yeah, that's how, yeah. Solastalgia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll have to get with that as well.
Yeah. I have a friend who we were in an Eco Dharma group together, just, you know, as our way of navigating it. You know, community is really important. So it's not realizing that we're not alone and that we have the support and care of one another to help us get through it. It's essential. Conversations are important and really being, you know, in a heart space with one another. So this one friend who actually told me about this word, you know, just actually sends an email and says, you know, I'm having a moment of solastalgia, just reaching out. And it was, mm-hmm. You know, it was in the earlier this month when the wildfires in Canada were blazing. They're still burning.
Yeah.
And the smoke is coming down. And it was just like, you know, just so much. I can't bear it anymore. So she just reached out.
Yeah.
And so we shared a moment of solastalgia together.
We should create a solastalgia. You know, telephone you can call, like a suicide line, you know, something like that. Well, tell us a little bit about your background, how you came into all of this, which is, you know, directly includes Buddhist practice and how you got to mind and life. But as a young person, what was the things that allowed for recognizing that there is a path beyond our selfish motivations, shall we say?
Yeah, you know, I was a kid who loved nature. I loved old people. So rather than, you know, going and playing with dolls and toys or ball, lots of times I would visit old people.
No Barbie, huh?
No, I wasn't into Barbie.
Guess you're not going to the Barbie movie.
I have no desire to go, but
you and me both.
But I know some people that I like who have gone and have liked it. So I'm
right. There must be something there.
Yeah, but I'm not drawn to go there. But anyway, so I know I wasn't playing Barbies, but I would hang out with animals. You said you love animals, mm. Real animal lover. I, you know, would rescue animals and hurt animals and. Mm. And old people was, you know, something that was really natural for me.
Mm.
Always spiritual, always asking the big questions and looking up at the sky. And
Even as a kid or a teenager?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And
who turned you on first in the spiritual realm?
It's not like I had one mentor. I was
not Alan Watts, Ram Dass, you know that.
Oh, I thought you were talking about like in my family as a child.
Oh, no. Growing up, you know, something came in from the either books or whatever.
Yeah, you know, I was I would still say that I'm kind of a spiritual mutt, if you will. I'm absolutely drawn to Buddhist philosophy. Buddhism, you know, is my grounding, my day-to-day grounding. But I don't necessarily consider myself Buddhist because there's many spiritual orientations that resonate with me. So my earliest entrance into Buddhism actually came from going to a Korean Zen Buddhist temple. And I was in my 20s at the time, and coming out of my mother had died, and I was coming out of a young unhealthy marriage. And was alone and broke and turned to meditation, and that was my entree.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And it felt like you know, kind of putting on a pair of comfortable shoes. It just felt really, really comfortable right from the very beginning.
Yeah, that's great. And then into I mean, at some point, Mind Life organization.
I actually started out as a nurse, so I don't know if you saw that in the book. I talk a little bit about it. I actually was an oncology and hospice
nurse.
Yeah,
that's right. I do remember.
That was my first job, and that was in the early 80s. And from that work and doing that work, I was really struck by the power of the mind and the mind-body-spirit connection, and really noticing that how people were living their lives really mattered. It mattered not only to how they were navigating it and coping, but also seemed to have an impact on their health and their disease. So I was really got the bug to go back to graduate school. And I got my graduate degree in a new interdisciplinary area of science. That was in the early 90s. It was called psychoneuroimmunology. And then from there, after that, and after I finished my postdoc in behavioral medicine, my first full-time faculty position was at the University of Massachusetts Medical School, where the Center of Mindfulness is. And Jon Kabat-Zinn was there at the time. And that's where I kind of merged my own personal meditation practice with my professional work. And I started researching meditation and researching meditation for people with serious illness. That was my initial entree into Mind and Life as a meditation researcher. And then fast forward years later, in 2015, I began the role of president of Mind and Life and leading this this organization.
Are you, and that's still going on for you, Susan?
I am. Yeah. I'm currently in that role. Yeah. Oh,
wonderful. No, I know of it quite well because of Sunanda Marcus, my sister-in-law, and Mirabai Bush, of course, who's also, both of who are involved with Love Server Member Foundation. So, oh, that's so great.
Wonderful. Small world.
Yeah, it always is. So, you know, well, let's pick, there's some wonderful, incredible quotes that you assembled in this book to, you know, feature around this subject, but something that struck me, and it was it's interesting because it's a book called Limits to Growth, and it was first published in 72, right? Dana is her name. I can't see your last
name. She goes by Donella Meadows, but since I have a personal connection with her, I called her Dana.
Well, how about
Dana Meadows?
Yeah. How about this?
Amazing. You know,
the depths of human ignorance are much more profound than most of us are willing to admit. This is especially so at a time when the global economy is coming together as a more integrated whole than it ever has been. And when that economy is pressing against the limits of a wondrously complex planet, and then wholly new ways of thinking are called for. At this time, no one knows enough. How about 1972? Here we are in 2013, right? I mean,
2023.
Yeah, 2023, 2013. And we are, we are mired in that thought. I mean, in that statement, all the way through, as a through line, much more integral in terms of the interconnectivity of everything as our world is on fire across the hemisphere.
Yeah.
It's just extraordinary. And what else does she say? The world's leaders do not know any better than anyone else how to bring about a sustainable society. Most of them don't even know it's necessary to do so. That is extraordinary on its face. But look what these people are doing with wars and continually, you know, digging out of the ground the substances to continue this archaic way of living that we are all part of.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
A sustainability revolution requires each person to act as a learning leader at some level, from family to community to nation to world. And it requires each of us to support leaders by allowing them to admit uncertainty, conduct honest experiments, and acknowledge mistakes. That seems far-fetched right now. So,
and it was far-fetched in the early 70s when she
absolutely.
Writing this.
Yeah.
But I do, and I think that that's the title of that book is perfect to the issues of limits to growth.
Mm.
You know, limits to growth. And we have this industrial growth society that is really driven by today. It's really driven by a lot of media and marketing, and this illusion or delusion that we think that we're separate from the natural world, and also that more and more and more and more is ultimately going to make us happy.
Yeah. It's all instant gratification. You know, these corporate entities need to keep producing X results in order to keep their shareholders happy, and that's what's driving everything. I mean, it is extraordinary. His Holiness said to Greta, "The human brain is something very special, remarkable. Yet, to judge from our world, we human beings are also the greatest troublemakers." Right. Mm-hmm. So, let's talk about using our very special brains to get us out of trouble, to transition to clean sources of energy, to minimize waste and air travel, to ride bikes and expand public transportation, to protect and expand forests, to preserve marshes, grasslands, and all natural habitats, to use agricultural practices that store carbon instead of releasing it to let trees and plants do their job of reaching up and taking carbon out of the air. That prescription, just look at it. And I hate to have sort of a negative view or defeatist view, which His Holiness talks a lot about, you and Greta, in this mm-hmm. book. This is absolutely counterproductive to get into that. But when you really look at it, using our, you know, the transitioning to clean sources of energy, minimizing waste and air travel. When you read through that catalog of what we need to do, how in the world, given what we're seeing, it is a little bit dark, no?
Well, I think when I hear that list, it seems really doable to me.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, just take, you know, one thing at a time. Can we cut down on our air travel? Can we do that? Are there new generations of engineers that are coming up with, you know, new sources of clean energy? That's actually happening pretty quickly, you know, right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are very large forces. And at the same time, there are individuals that are, making decisions and, living their lives. And if each one of us did that, each 8 billion of us, we can begin to, you know, tip things. Although we know, in A Future We Can Love, I talk about climate feedback loops. Begin with that, the knowledge of climate feedback loops, which is a, you know, really, really interesting phenomenon that I wasn't aware of until actually the conversation that Mind and Life hosted with the Dalai Lama and Greta and climate scientists. But essentially, it's the warming of the earth is warming itself. So as, for example, the trees are dying because of fires or disease or insects, right? And you have these old, and also humans are cutting them down as well. But you have big old growth forests that are dying. And what happens? All the carbon that they've been storing for years is released. You have the permafrost, thousands of years of plants and bones that have been in the, you know, been frozen up in the tundra are thawing. What happens when they thaw? All that's released. So the warming is warming itself. And we know that we can begin to slow down the feedback loops by stopping fossil fuel use and our dependence on that and going toward greener energy and renewable energy. But we also know that regreening makes a big difference as well. And so minimizing clear cutting and looking at what we can do to plant more trees actually can help as well.
Mm. In the book, I remember a story of His Holiness coming with a bunch of seeds, right?
Yeah, he did that. He did that actually at the Kali Chakra. I think it was in 1990. And he did that as part of, let me see. Yeah, it was in 1990. And it's at the Kali Chakra in India, in Sarnath. And had gotten money from his Nobel Prize, receiving the Nobel Prize. And he gave out tree seeds. Mm. And he gave out a variety of tree seeds and was very, very conscious and intentional of giving information and trying to have them be seeds that were appropriate for that part of the world. And kind of cool. I did put out a call to try to find out one person who might have planted a tree who was at that Kali Chakra, because it would be, you know, 30 years later, there's like a tree.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, well. Talking about trees, so there's one thing, you know, I was reading and you talked about getting with a friend and making a point of going for a walk with the intention of finding a special tree. Mm-hmm. And I really connected with that because I do that all the time, actually. Mm. Yeah, this morning it just happened to me again on a walk that I've been on a million times. Mm-hmm. And suddenly just the impression of this extraordinary tree here. I mean, California and Ojai. And then you say it's grown into a kind of walking meditation. And it reminds me of, and I love this, unscientifically speaking, trees are miracles. What they do with photosynthesis, et cetera, et cetera. But they're also living examples, trees in a forest. This is something, a famous story of Ram Dass's, where he talks about, you know, you walk around all day judging everything, everyone you meet, whatever phenomena that comes to you, you're judging it left and right. This is what, you know, we do as, shall we say, unsophisticated humans. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then, but you go into a forest. And you see there's trees bent, there's trees that are large around their middle, there's trees that are providing shade that's incredible, there's just an enormous variety. Do you judge any of it? No. You know, I always love that story because I can really relate with that reality.
Yeah. Yeah, trees, I have deep affinity for trees. You know, we are into breathing with the trees. We cannot survive as a species without trees and plants and vegetation. We can't. I mean, it's pretty simple.
Animals and insects, all of it. Yeah.
And all, exactly. And then, you know, trees also, you have these big old trees that have these root systems that hold the water in. And that's where, you know, streams and natural streams, you know, come from. They're coming from the water of the roots of the trees. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you see that fantastic fungi movie, Louis Schwarzberg?
Yeah.
I mean.
Oh, yeah. All the mycelium under the ground. Yeah.
Yeah. The extraordinary interconnection of these living beings. So, which brings me, and you also, in the book, you refer to Jinpa quite a bit, Thupten mm-hmm. Jinpa, you know, who is the Dalai Lama's longtime English translator. I've met him and done podcasts with him. He's just an extraordinarily wonderful being who's also living in Montreal right now, where I'm from. But yeah, talk about, would you tell everybody and explain a little bit Indra's net?
Yeah, my understanding in Jinpa, we were in conversation and, you know, talking about it, but it's basically how every single one of us, all the beings, so just imagine that we are these gems, these jewels. And in it, we are reflecting all the other gems that we're connected to, that in the universe, that every single one of us is part of this, what's called the Indra's net. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when I imagine it, I just imagine these beautiful, you know, sparkling, web of all of us, that we're not, we are all, we are who we are because of each other. And we don't exist in isolation. We are in this interdependent world.
Yeah. And Jinpa says there is no center. We're all in it together, depending on one another. Depending on one another. We, being everyone in the everything in the universe, and it being an infinite web of cause and effect. And he says, of course, there's no way for the human mind to be able to grasp all the points of interconnection. For that, we'd have to be omniscient. You know, so, I mean, my story is going back to with Ram Dass to India the second time when he went back to meet Neem Karoli Baba. I think mm-hmm. you know who that is from Be Here mm-hmm. Now, our guru. Mm-hmm. And being in the deep feeling of that reality with somebody who was living that reality was so extraordinary. I had not imagined anything like that, you know, was possible. But and as Ram Dass said when he first came back, actually, he said, I wouldn't have gotten that understanding without the use of psychedelics that I had been, or the experimentations I had been doing with Leary and Metzner and everybody else, that led me to that understanding, deep understanding, not intellectual, of the interconnection of all things. And interdependence is a word that you use here. Yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah. Well, I think that that's actually the root of the problems as it relates to the climate crisis and the root of the solutions. And one thing I do talk about in the book, you know, is to talk about the climate feedback loops, but I also talk about human feedback loops. And with human feedback loops, basically it's the three Buddhist poisons. So first one, delusion. And what's the delusion? The delusion is that we don't realize that we're interdependent and interconnected with one another. And, you know, it's you know, it's pretty, pretty simple, as you know, as a practice person. Once we begin to unpack it and just look at our lives moment to moment, every single thing about it is interdependent. So what we breathe, what we eat, what we drink, what we wear, you know, everything. I share in the book, I had this moment, I started, you know, in my heartbreak, if you will, and just trying to do what I could do, and just sort of one foot in front of the other, literally, I started a Sunday ritual of going out and picking up trash in an area that you would think there isn't a lot of trash, but actually, if you look deeper in the vegetation on the side of the road, it's actually trash. So I'd take a bag and I'd walk along the road. I had this realization about picking up a single-use plastic bottle. There's just basically the trash on the side of the road is mostly single-use plastic. Water and other forms of beverages, oftentimes with, you know, alcohol. But that plastic bottle, that single-use plastic, where it came from and how it was made and all of the causes and conditions that got it to you, you know, from the store to the trucks that transported it, to the company that's making it. It's like there's many, 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 many points of just that coming to you. And then that plastic bottle thrown on the side of the road. And I've heard that it takes more than 1,000 years for plastic to degrade. And so you have these, you know, these microplastics, these phthalates that are then going into the soil, into the insects, the worms, into our water. And it's, you know, we as people need to rise up and to do everything we can to stop plastics and to minimize at least single-use plastics need to stop. And you know, it's just raising awareness for that. So interdependence, there's so much we could talk about because everything, you know, there's so much as it relates to interdependence. But the first human feedback loop that I see is delusion, that we don't recognize our interdependence and our interconnectedness. Second human feedback loop, I'll pause there. And so I want to hear your thoughts on interdependence as somebody who's thought about interdependence.
Yeah. Well, there's so many different ways. I unfortunately, when you start talking about the plastic and single-use plastic, it was like those whales that formed the heart, you know, that I ran over that picture, couldn't handle it. And then this morning, I saw another thing. New York Times is a horror, by the way. I mean, Jesus, what the world is really a horror, but the way they reflect it, it's like, oh my God. This was all of that, our garbage landing, I think it's Guatemala, on the shores of that country. I may be wrong because I don't even know if that's a reality, but somewhere in South America, just extraordinary amounts of plastic that is coming in on the ocean and it's just being deposited on the beach there. You know, nobody cares because, well, we're not connected there. We're not dependent on them. If it happened, you know, where I am, you know, on the beach here in California, it would get people's attention big time. I mean, we already have, again, back to animals, red tide, okay? The small fish are getting sick because of eating plankton that's the ocean's too warm and et cetera, et cetera. And then sea lions and seals are eating it. They're actually, as I take my dog for a walk on the beach over the last month, 2 months, they're dying, but they're not dead. Some of them are actually dying right in front of you. They won't go back in the water. They're just, I mean, it is, when you see something like that and realize of the absolute interconnection of everything, you know, what's going on in this ocean, it's extraordinary. Interdependence. I mean, it's hard to imagine where people don't have a sense of that interdependence when our daily lives, as you mentioned before, in every way are connected with each other, with phenomena, with nature, with animals, with insects. And, you know, just it comes back to, I think you've quoted, actually, you know, Roshi Halifax. I'm just remembering.
I know her well.
Me too. She's just wonderful. We did a whole thing around hope, one retreat that we did with Ram Dass in Maui or something. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, I have to really kind of set, you know, that thought, wise hope, she named it. Mm-hmm. You know, not just this, well, we hope things are going to be better, you know, the way that we use hope, but wise hope. And that's the realization of interdependence is based on a wisdom that we need to cultivate and we need to share, which is a lot of hopefully the work that we do around what Ram Dass, continuing what he's done from Neem Karoli Baba and from all of the people that we're involved with, including, you know, those like Jack Kornfield and Sharon and Joseph, you know, all of these wonderful teachers.
Yeah. And that's the hope, though. I mean, because of interdependence, we could say, well, that's, you know, our, you know, what the problem is. And it is what, you know, that's why things are so dire. And at the same time, that's where the hope is because we are one atmosphere. And if we all start to, and we share oceans, then, you know, we all can influence what is happening in another part of the world.
We're going to give some real consideration. That garbage is coming from us that's landing on the shores of this country, wherever, South America, in the Far East, all over the place.
And Raghu, before it goes there, it's in the water and the whales and the other sea creatures are actually being exposed to it and swallowing it. So plastic is something that I talk a lot about, think a lot about, and try to just raise awareness, you know. And I hear people, you know, I was with some, you know, some old friends recently, and there's this, you know, we live on autopilot. We being the general we, and when we have busy, stressful lives with a lot of different demands, particularly because of industrial growth society, and we need to make a certain amount of money for our families in order to keep up certain lifestyles. What do? We look for easy ways of getting through the day and easy ways of, so you go and get something that's prepared in plastic, because it's easier because that's the energy that you have because of what you've done. So there's this deep, 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 recognition, seeing clearly and healing that needs to happen. And it is happening. It is happening.
Mm. No, it's got to happen with Next Gen too. They are definitely, a lot of consideration by them about this.
Well, I'm pretty amazed at a lot of the young people that I'm meeting. There are, I mean, they get it, you know, in general by the masses, they get it a lot more than those of us that are a lot older.
Yeah, absolutely. You also, wait, have we finished? There was a couple of
The two other feedback loops.
Yeah, feedback.
Okay,
loops.
So they're basically the Buddha's poison. So next one is craving, which we've kind of talked about, right? And desire. And so that's just wanting and wanting and more and more and feeling like we're not enough. right? So there's this constant striving and craving. That's absolutely very fundamental to the climate crisis right now. And us stopping that craving can make a big difference, particularly in
And just, it's funny because take that all the way and it'll make a huge ass difference. You know, Joseph Goldstein, there's a little story. Yeah. He, a young man who was driving Joseph around in Maui when we were doing a retreat, said to Joseph, "You have all this experience. Give me one piece of advice out of all of what you can give me, because I know you have so much." And Joseph said, "Stop grasping, period." And that consideration just covers a lot of territory. Everything that we're talking about, interconnectivity and interdependence, and you know, that's why you know, Ram Dass is great in the way that he fix yourself as you are trying to do the social action that's needed in this world. You got to fix your own heart, or else you're not going to be very productive in terms of what you're doing. And starting there is about grasping, you know, and
and then the third relates to that. The flip side is aversion, and related to that, which I say is disliking. And disliking what? Two things that we dislike as it relates to climate. One is changing. We don't want to change our habits, our little comforts. There's a dislike to that. And so we think we have to give up a lot in order to and live without. And actually I challenge us to think about, well, if we're giving up, what do we have to gain? What do we have to gain? So there's a lot of possibility. Instead of traveling across the world to go on exotic vacation, just go for a walk, you know, and get the trees, really connect deeply with community, with family. But so there's this disliking of wanting to change. And then the other part of disliking, and you touched upon this in the beginning, Raghu, is disliking the truth of what's happening. And so what do? We numb ourselves. We get numb. We put our head in the sand. We make like, you know, it's not happening.
And, yeah, it's a Frank Zappa song from the 60s. It can't happen here.
Yeah. So anyway, those are the three human feedback loops that I think are contributing to not only the climate crisis, but also some of the chaos around how we're all dealing with it.
You quote Vandana Shiva, an amazing, amazing human. Did you meet her?
I have met her. Yeah. I'm going to see her also this fall.
Oh, really?
I've met her virtually.
Uh huh.
And I'm going to meet her. I'm going to meet her in person this fall, hopefully. And one of my rare trips. I don't take many anymore, but.
Oh, yeah? Good for you. Yeah. Anyway, I love this part of the book, you know, where she talks about all of the fathers of modern science, Descartes, Bacon, and so on. And I love what she said. This way of thinking, it didn't just separate us from the earth, it separated mind from body and created a very artificial idea of what the mind is. Very Cartesian, very mechanical, very militaristic, and also very privileged. But that's what a perfect description of people that we have in front of us all around the world that are taking on the most important roles of leading governments and countries. It's unbelievable. It denied intelligence to a living earth and to every one of her non-human organisms, every plant, every microbe, every seed. Mm-hmm. Boy, oh boy. And I think you say, without blaming Descartes for the witch hunts, I take the point that this way of seeing the world in one another has had profound effects on how we relate. And that, you know, that's... you know, the interdependence thing comes up really strongly there, doesn't it?
Yeah. And Vandana actually continues talking about the sacredness, like we've lost, and a lot of the indigenous wisdom, which I've also talked about in the book, talks about the sacredness of the natural world. And we've lost that. And we need to reconnect with it. And part of why we lost it, though, is this this mindset that was created a few hundred years ago and really, you know, took off with the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah. Which is why we need to practically beg our indigenous wisdom keepers to come back and share with us, which many, many, many are doing.
Yes.
And I mean, that is, to me, one of the most important ways I think that we can get back to a place where we are not giving lip service to interconnection, interdependence, and so on with all things. It's they had it in the past. Of course, we killed them as much as we could, white people. But now I think there's an opportunity there. I think that's one of our largest opportunities, actually, is with indigenous wisdom people.
I agree with you. I think it's absolutely essential to the overall healing all over the planet. There's indigenous peoples all over the planet. And if we're giving them the, you know, the ability, the opportunity to teach us, and for us to listen, it actually can be really, really pivotal.
Yeah. Another person that I really respect, and someone else I haven't met, like Vandana Shiva, is Joanna Macy. She is so wise and still with us here in her early 90s. What did she say? This is a political economy, and the operative word is growth, a political economy that sets its goals and measures its success in growth. Growth in what? Wisdom, health, longevity, creativity? One thing only, alas, only one thing, and that's the industrial growth society cares about its profits, rubbing her thumb and first two fingers together in the sign of cash. How do we even?
She nailed it. Nailed it. Yeah. And there are definitely in this conversation, there are people that are, you know, seriously talking about how we need to change the, you know, the economic system. Like if we really are, like it needs a major overhaul in order for us to get to the bottom of this.
Here's a piece of news that's more bright light rather than the couple of things I've been mentioning, which were a little dark, not dark, but real. This was something I saw in 60 Minutes, which was somebody who was involved with energy company. Mm-hmm. And he saw an opportunity in a fishing village in a cove in England. Mm-hmm. Where he was able to set out a wind farm. I mean, huge, all the way into the ocean. And these people, because they were cut off, obviously, fishing is less of that going on, and they were cut off from the livelihood, and he was able to get this thing going where they had jobs, you know, several hundred people in this little village. So there's somebody who took it upon himself, and, I think it's a profit making endeavor. It didn't look like, you know, it was something he was doing, you know, as a philanthropist. That's a good example of, you know, wise efforts to make this kind of a change. No,
yeah. So I'm really glad that you shifted the conversation towards this, because there actually are many examples in Future We Can Love about that are inspiring. For example, in Cambodia, they had the lumber poachers become forest guards of the forest, and, you know, helping these people to have earn livelihoods that are doing the right thing to protect the forest and all the animals in the forest. So they became from poachers to guards. There are now, you know, there are companies that are making products that are, you know, using innovations. So until there's an overhaul of our economic system, what can we do within the capitalistic societies that we, you know, that we live in? So there's this new there are these sneakers that are being made from, they're being made from decomposable plants and minerals.
Really?
And the person who started the company, yes, it's Unless Collective. And it was started by somebody who is a Adidas executive.
Wow.
Yeah. And there's many examples like that that are good for the environment, that are still going, that are products that are useful.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, you know, more and more of us are using, reusing. There's these reuse shops. There's community sharing. So not every house in the neighborhood has to have a lawnmower and, you know, all the equipments that you need. But if we're sharing more, then we don't have to buy as much, right? And there's, I don't know, I expect you see it in your community in California, but there's refilleries. So to, instead of buying new plastics every time, you can go and fill up your Dr. Bronner's bottle. so you don't have to get a new one every time.
Yeah.
So there are more and more. And so there are countless examples. The city of Tucson, the mayor made a commitment to plant 1 million trees.
I didn't know that. Well, wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, this is a story that goes back a long time ago, but it's one that's so inspiring for me. And it's this, leader, this woman, Wangari Maathai, who is in Kenya. She actually had gotten the Nobel Prize, but she started out and she lived in a small village in Kenya and had this connection with the tree. Her mother said the tree of God sat by the stream, and they were in right relationship with each other because, you know, when the rains came, the tree held the waters, which then went into the soil, which fed the stream. And it became her sacred place when she was a little girl. And then what happened? She went off to university. She came back. The tree was gone. It was cut down. The water, there was no more stream. Oh, and all the frogs that she used to play with and the frogs' eggs that she saw when she was a child were all gone. Nothing was there. And she pursued her doctoral studies as it related to environmental issues. And in her research, she realized that the women in the communities in the villages actually were very poor and weren't able to cook because there was no longer wood because all the trees had been cut down. And there wasn't water because the streams were gone. And so what she did is she began this movement to empower women and to also, you know, help the planet and the communities. And with the few women, they started, and then it grew and grew to thousands and tens of thousands of women. And then it's called the Green Belt Movement. It was created, and they've planted over 50 million trees. And these women had right livelihood, and Wangari, actually the second dictator of Kenya, basically tortured them, and then eventually, through wise action, they basically overturned the government, and she ended up going to parliament with 98% of the vote. She got the Nobel Prize. And the impact of this one woman who woke up, who basically saw the connection, the interconnectedness of everything, and began to, you know, take action. So her story is super,
wow,
you know, inspiring. And there's, amazing. You know, there are a lot of, you know, young people today that are doing really extraordinary things.
Yeah. Wow.
So I think, yeah, I'll pause.
That's very good. Nice positivity to move away from the negativity. So we're close to the end here, but there's one thing I know, and you said in the book, I never expected to be a meditation teacher or lead meditations or anything, but you got one from the 17th Karmapa. Is that not true?
Actually, it was Dakila Chongyapa provided. Dakila Chongyapa.
Yeah.
Actually is a student of the Karmapa.
Oh, I see.
And Dakila actually runs an organization. It's called the Loka Initiative at the University of Wisconsin. And it is bringing different faith groups together. Essentially really, really brilliant because, the faith communities actually have a lot of influence in their communities. So working, with faith communities to create climate awareness and look at what they can do as communities, the ripples can go far and wide. So Dakila actually she actually wrote that meditation.
Oh, she did.
I invited her to do that, to include that contribution. Mm. And it's basically a meditation for eco anxiety and how we can.
I think that's how I started this whole conversation about my own eco anxiety. And I do know, by the way, that the 17th Karmapa is very involved with ecology and with working to help that and also rights of women in monastery situations.
Yeah. But
can you do a short thing at least to lead us into some way to assuage that anxiety by doing a particular meditation?
How long are we looking at? Just like 2 minutes?
Yeah, several minutes. Yeah, 2, 3, 4 minutes.
Yeah.
People, just their attention. Yeah. Our attention span is limited, but
we'll keep it brief. But I do think that having conversations like this can be activating.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
And so I think just taking a few minutes together just to ground and to just settle. And so, taking a few minutes now to feel your feet on the floor or the ground. Perhaps imagining roots growing from the soles of your feet all the way down into the soil. Connecting with the moisture, the insects, the mycelium. And bringing awareness to the top of your head. And having your spine be long. And bringing awareness to the breath, the breathing. Allowing a fullness as you inhale. Awareness of the oxygen entering your body. Filling your lungs and your belly. And just letting go. You exhale. Exhaling carbon dioxide. And bringing an awareness of how we are interbeing with trees and plants. Breathing in oxygen that comes from the green leaves. Breathing out your exhale is then nourishing vegetation, the trees. Noticing what's alive in you right now. Your heart. Perhaps breathing in heaviness and darkness, sorrow. In your heart, transforming with love, compassion, breathing out light. Perhaps bringing to mind an awareness of being one gem in this interconnected, infinite web of life. And love. All over the planet. All people, animals, birds, fishes, whales, insects. Remembering we are not alone. May every being be safe and protected from harm. May we be happy and have peace of mind. May we be free from pain. And healthy and strong. And may we live with ease. May we be at ease. Moment by moment, breath by breath, right here, right now. Thank you.
Wonderful, Susan. Wonderful. I have to add one thing from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who recited these lines from the 8th century Buddhist teacher, Shantideva. Whatever suffering there is in the world, it all stems from self-centeredness. Whatever happiness there is in the world, it all stems from wishing happiness for others. What more needs to be said? Just look at the difference between the two. The childish who seek their own well-being and the Buddha who seeks other well-being. Others' well-being. Therefore, if one does not switch this outlook of self-centeredness to other-centeredness, let alone the attainment of Buddhahood, even in this life, there will be no real joy. 8th century, Shantideva.
Shantideva.
Thanks so much. Oh, God. Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us today, Susan.
Yeah, thank you, Raghu.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. You know, we're in it together. I you know, hear the heaviness, and you know, I want to, you know, share some words that Paul Hawkins shared that stick with me, because it's like, to me, both are true. So if we look at the science and we're not pessimistic, you don't have the correct data. And if you meet people in this climate movement, the amazing people all over the world in this climate movement, and you're not optimistic, you don't have a heart. Both are true.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Wow, yeah. That's so great. And everybody, of course, in the show notes for this podcast, there'll be links to, you can get the new book, A Future We Can Love. It's fairly new. And and also, you know, just see Mind Life and the work Susan is doing there. We'll have links to that as well. And we'll have to do this again, because there's plenty more here that's just wonderful information.
Yeah.
So thanks again for being here. This is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com, and all of Susan and my friends are there. With wonderful podcasts. So we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you.